bag of hair in question from the counter and made as if to leave with it, but the elder woman snatched it away.
"Please don't embarrass yourself further. We both have seen the ends. 25 is all I can give you for it. You won't get more some other place. Please, now," she said, looking over the girl's shoulder to Irie. "Other customers I have."
Irie saw hot tears, not unlike her own, spring to the girl's eyes. She seemed to freeze for a moment, vibrating ever so slightly with anger. Then she slammed her hand down on the counter, swept up her £25, and headed for the door. The fat lady shook her chins in contempt after the disappearing girl. "Ungrateful she is." Then she unpeeled a sticky label from its brown paper backing and slapped it on the bag of hair. It said, 6 meters, Indian, straight, black, red.
"Yes, dear. What is it I can do?"
Irie repeated Andrew's instruction and handed over the card.
8 packets? That is about 6 meters, no?
"I don't know."
"Yes, yes it is. You want it straight or with a wave?"
"Straight. Dead straight." The fat lady did a silent calculation and then picked up the bag of hair that the girl had just left.
"This is what you're looking for. I haven't been able to package it, you understand, but it is absolutely clean. You want?"
Irie looked dubious.
"Don't worry about what I said. No split ends. Just silly girl trying to get more than she deserves. Some people got no understanding of simple economics. It hurts her to cut off her hair so £1 million she expects or something crazy. Beautiful hair she has. When I was young, oh, mine was beautiful too, eh?"
The fat lady erupted into high-pitched laughter, her busy upper lip making her moustache quiver. The laugh subsided.
"Tell Andrea that will be £37.50. We Indian women have the beautiful hair, eh? Everybody wants it."
A black woman with children in a twin buggy was waiting behind Irie with a packet of hairpins. She sucked her teeth.
"You people think you're all Mr. Big Stuff," she muttered, half to herself. "Some of us are happy with our African hair, thank you very much. I don't want to buy some poor Indian girl's hair, and I wish to God I could buy black hair products from black people for once. How are we going to make it in this country if we don't make our own business?"
The skin around the fat lady's mouth became very tight. She began talking 12 to the dozen, putting Irie's hair in a bag and writing her out a receipt, addressing all her comments to the woman via Irie, while doing the best to ignore the other woman's interjections.
"You don't like shopping here? Then please don't be shopping here. Is forcing you anybody? No. Is anybody? It's amazing, people, the rudeness. I am not a racist, but I can't understand it. I'm just providing a service, a service. I don't need abuse. Just leave your money on the counter. If I am getting abuse, I am not serving." "No one's giving you abuse, Jesus Christ. Is it my fault if they want the hair that is straight and paler skin sometimes, like Michael Jackson? My fault he is too? They tell me not to sell the Dr. Peacock whitener. Local paper. My God, what a fuss. And then they buy it. Take that receipt to Andrea, will you, my dear, please? I'm just trying to make a living in this country like the rest of everybody. There you are, dear. There's your hair."
The woman reached around Irie and delivered the right change to the counter with an angry smash.
"For fuck's sake. I can't help it if that's what they want. Supply, demand, and bad language I won't tolerate. Simple economics. Mind your step on the way out, dear. And you, no, don't come back, please. I will call the police. I won't be threatened. The police, I will call them. Yeah, yeah, yeah."
Irie held the door open for the double buggy and took one side to help carry it over the front step. Outside, the woman put her hairpins in her pocket. She looked exhausted.
"I hate that place," she said. "But I need hairpins."
"I need hair," said Irie. The woman shook her head.
"You've got hair," she said.
5.5 hours later, thanks to an arduous operation that involved plaiting somebody else's hair in small sections to Irie's own 2 inches and sealing it with glue, Irie Jones had a full head of long, straight, reddish black hair.
"Is it straight?"
she asked, disbelieving the evidence of her own eyes.
"Straight as hell,"
said Andrea, admiring her handiwork.
But, honey, you're going to have to plait it properly if you want it to stay in. Why won't you let me plait it? It won't stay in if it's loose like that.
It will, said Irie, bewitched by her own reflection. It's got to. He, Milat, need only see it once, after all, just once. To ensure she reached him in pristine state, she walked all the way to the Iqbal house with her hands on her hair, terrified that the wind would displace it. Alsana answered the door.
Oh, hello. No, he's not here. Out. Don't ask me where.
He doesn't tell me a thing. I know where Majid is more of the time.
Irie walked into the hallway and caught a sneaky glance of herself in the mirror. Still there and all in the right place.
Can I wait in here?
Of course. You look different, dearie.
Lost weight?
Irie glowed.
New haircut.
Oh, yes. You look like a newsreader. Very nice.
Now, in the living room, please. Niece of shame and a nasty friend are in there, but try not to let that bother you. I'm working in the kitchen and Samad is weeding, so keep the noise down.
Irie walked into the lounge.
Bloody hell!
Screeched Nina at the approaching vision.
What the fuck do you look like?
She looked beautiful. She looked straight, unkinky, beautiful.
You look like a freak! Fuck me! Maxine, man, check this out! Jesus Christ, Irie! What exactly were you aiming for?
Wasn't it obvious? Straight? Straightness? Flickability?
I mean, what was the grand plan? The Negro Meryl Streep?
Nina folded over like a duvet and laughed herself silly.
Niece of shame, came Alsana's voice from the kitchen. Sewing requires concentration. Shut it up, Miss Big Mouth, please.
Nina's nasty friend, otherwise known as Nina's girlfriend, a sexy and slender girl called Maxine with a beautiful porcelain face, dark eyes and a lot of curly brown hair, gave a pull to Irie's peculiar bangs.
What have you done? You had beautiful hair, man. All curly and wild. It was gorgeous.
Irie couldn't say anything for a moment. She had not considered the possibility that she looked anything less than terrific.
I just had a haircut. What's the big deal?
But that's not your hair! For fuck's sake! That's some poor, oppressed Pakistani woman who needs the cash for her kids!
Said Nina, giving it a tug and being rewarded with a handful of it.
Oh, shit!
Nina and Maxine had a hysteria relapse.
Just get off it, okay?
Irie retreated to an armchair and tucked her knees up under her chin. Trying to sound offhand, she asked,
So, where's Milat?
Is that what this is all in aid of?
Asked Nina, astonished.
My shit for brains cousin G.
No, fuck off. Well, he's not here. He's got some new bird, Eastern Bloc gymnast with a stomach like a washboard. Not unattractive, spectacular tits, but tight-assed as hell. Name?
Name?
Stasia, said Maxine, looking up briefly from top of the pops. Or some such bollocks.
Irie sank deeper into the ruined springs of Samad's favourite chair.
Irie, will you take some advice? Ever since I've known you, you've been following that boy around like a lost dog. And in that time, he's snogged everyone apart from you. He's even snogged me, and I'm his first cousin, for fuck's sake.
And me, said Maxine, and I'm not that way inclined.
Haven't you ever wondered why he hasn't snogged you?
Because I'm ugly and fat, with an afro.
No, fuckface, because you're all he's got. He needs you. You two have history. You really know him. Look how confused he is. One day he's a la this, a la that. Next minute it's big busty blondes, Russian gymnasts and a smoke of the sensimilla. He doesn't know his arse from his elbow, just like his father. He doesn't know who he is, but you know him, at least a little. You've known all the sides of him and he needs that. You're different.
Irie rolled her eyes. Sometimes you want to be different, and sometimes you'd give the hair on your head to be the same as everybody else.
Look, you're a smart cookie, Irie, but you've been taught all kinds of shit. You've got to re-educate yourself, realise your value. Stop the slavish devotion and get a life, Irie. Get a girl, get a guy, but get a life.
You're a very sexy girl, Irie, said Maxine sweetly.
Yeah, right. Trust her, she's a raving dyke,
said Nina, ruffling Maxine's hair affectionately and giving her a kiss.
But the truth is the Barbra Streisand cut you've got there ain't doing shit for you. The afro was cool, man. It was wicked. It was yours.
Suddenly, Elsana appeared at the doorway with an enormous plate of biscuits and a look of intense suspicion. Maxine blew her a kiss.
Biscuits, Irie? Come and have some biscuits with me in the kitchen.
Nina groaned.
Don't panic, Auntie. We're not enlisting her into the cult of Sappho.
I don't care what you're doing. I don't know what you're doing. I don't want to know such things.
We're watching television.
It was Madonna on the TV screen, working her hands around two conically shaped breasts.
Very nice, I'm sure,
sniped Alsana, glaring at Maxine.
Biscuits, Irie?
I'd like some biscuits,
murmured Maxine with a flutter of her extravagant eyelashes.
I am certain,
said Alsana slowly and pointedly, translating code.
I don't have the kind you like.
Nina and Maxine fell about all over again.
Irie,
said Alsana, indicating the kitchen with a grimace. Irie followed her out.
I'm as liberal as the next person,
complained Alsana once they were alone.
But why do they always have to be laughing and making a song and dance about everything? I cannot believe homosexuality is that much fun.
Heterosexuality certainly is not.
I don't think I want to hear that word in this house again, said Samad, deadpan, stepping in from the garden and laying his weeding gloves on the table.
Which one?
Either. I am trying my level best to run a godly house.
Samad spotted a figure at his kitchen table, frowned, decided it was indeed Irie Jones, and began on the little routine the two of them had going.
Hello, Miss Jones, and how is your father?
Irie shrugged on cue.
You see him more than we do. How's God?
Perfectly fine, thank you. Have you seen my good-for-nothing son recently?
Not recently.
What about my good son?
Not for years.
Will you tell the good-for-nothing he's a good-for-nothing when you find him?
I'll do my best, Mr. Iqbal.
God bless you.
Gesundheit.
Now, if you will excuse me.
Samad reached for his prayer mat from the top of the fridge and left the room.
What's the matter with him?
Asked Irie, noticing that Samad had delivered his lines with less than enthusiasm.
He seems, I don't know, sad.
Alsana sighed.
He is sad. He feels like he has screwed everything up. Of course he has screwed everything up. But then again, who will cast the first stone, etc.? He prays and prays. But he will not look straight at the facts. Milat hanging around with God knows what kind of people, always with the white girls, and Majid.
Irie remembered her first sweetheart encircled by a fuzzy halo of perfection, an illusion born of the disappointments Milat had afforded her over the years.
Why? What's wrong with Majid?
Alsana frowned and reached up to the top kitchen shelf, where she collected a thin airmail envelope and passed it to Irie. Irie removed the letter and the photograph inside. The photo was of Majid, now a tall, distinguished-looking young man. His hair was the deep black of his brother's, but it was not brushed forward on his face. It was parted on the left side, slicked down and drawn behind the right ear. He was dressed in a tweed suit and what looked, though one couldn't be sure, the photo was not good, like a cravat. He held a large sun hat in one hand. In the other, he clasped the hand of the eminent Indian writer, Sir R.V. Sarasvati. Sarasvati was dressed all in white, with his broad-rimmed hat on his head and an ostentatious cane in his free hand. The two of them were posed in a somewhat self-congratulatory manner, smiling broadly and looking for all the world as if they were about to pat each other roundly on the back or had just done so. The midday sun was out and bouncing off Dhaka University's front steps, where the whole scene had been captured. Alsana inched a smear off the photo with her index finger.
You know Sarasvati?
Irie nodded. Compulsory GCSE text, A Stitch in Time by R.V. Sarasvati, a bittersweet tale of the last days of empire. Samad hates Sarasvati, you understand. Calls him colonial throwback, English liquor of behinds. Irie picked a paragraph at random from the letter and read aloud. As you can see, I was lucky enough to meet India's very finest writer one bright day in March. After winning an essay competition, my title, Bangladesh, to whom may she turn, I travelled to Dhaka to collect my prize, a certificate and a small cash reward, from the great man himself in a ceremony at the university. I am honoured to say he took a liking to me, and we spent a most pleasant afternoon together, a long, intimate tea followed by a stroll through Dhaka's more appealing prospects. During our lengthy conversations, Sir Sarasvati commended my mind and even went so far as to say, and I quote, that I was a first-rate young man, a comment I shall treasure. He suggested my future might lie in the law, the university, or even his own profession of the creative pen. I told him the first-mentioned vocation was closest to my heart, and that it had long been my intention to make the Asian countries sensible places where order prevailed, disaster was prepared for, and a young boy was in no danger from a falling vase. New laws, new stipulations are required, I told him, to deal with our unlucky fate, the natural disaster. But then he corrected me. Not fate, he said. Too often we Indians, we Bengalis, we Pakistanis throw up our hands and cry, fate, in the face of history. But many of us are uneducated, many of us do not understand the world. We must be more like the English. The English fight fate to the death. They do not listen to history unless it is telling them what they wish to hear. We say, it had to be. It does not have to be. Nothing does. In one afternoon, I learnt more from this great man than, he learns nothing. Samad marched back into the kitchen in a fury and threw the kettle on the stove. He learns nothing from a man who knows nothing. Where is his beard? Where is his chemise? Where is his humility? If Allah says there will be storm, there will be storm. If he says earthquake, it will be earthquake. Of course it has to be. That is the very reason I sent the child there, to understand that essentially we are weak, that we are not in control. What does Islam mean? What does the word, the very word, mean? I surrender. I surrender to God. I surrender to Him. This is not my life. This is His life. This life I call mine is His to do with what He will. Indeed, I shall be tossed and turned on the wave, and there shall be nothing to be done. Nothing! Nature itself is Muslim, because it obeys the laws the Creator has ingrained in it. Don't you preach in this house, Samad, Mia. There are places for that sort of thing. Go to mosque, but don't do it in the kitchen. People have to be eating in here. But we do not automatically obey. We are tricky. We are the tricky bastards. We humans. We have the evil inside us, the free will. You must learn to obey. That is what I sent the child, Majid Mahfouz Murshed Mubtazim Iqbal, to discover. Tell me, did I send him to have his mind poisoned by a Rule Britannia worshipping Hindu old queen? Maybe, Samad Mia. Maybe not. Don't, Elsie, I warn you. Oh, go on, you old pot boiler. Alsana gathered her spare tires around her like a sumo wrestler. You say we have no control, yet you always try to control everything. Let go, Samad Mia. Let the boy go. He is second generation. He was born here. Naturally, he will do things differently. You can't plan everything. After all, what is so awful? So he's not training to be an alim, but he's educated, he's clean. And is that all you ask of your son, that he be clean? Maybe, Samad Mia, maybe. And don't speak to me of second generation, one generation, indivisible, eternal. Somewhere in the midst of this argument, Irie slipped out of the kitchen and headed for the front door. She caught an unfortunate glimpse of herself in the scratch and stain of the hall mirror. She looked like the love child of Diana Ross and Engelbert Humperdinck. You have to let them make their own mistakes. came Alsana's voice from the heat of battle, travelling through the cheap wood of the kitchen door and into the hallway, where Airi stood, facing her own reflection, busy tearing out somebody else's hair with her bare hands. Like any school, Glenard Oak had a complex geography. Not that it was particularly labyrinthine in design. It had been built in two simple stages, first in 1886 as a workhouse, result large red monstrosity, Victorian asylum, and then added to in 1963 when it became a school, result grey monolith, brave new council estate. The two monstrosities were then linked in 1974 by an enormous perspex tubular footbridge. But a bridge was not enough to make the two places one or to slow down the student body's determination to splinter and factionalize. The school had learnt to its cost that you cannot unite 1,000 children under one Latin tag, school code, laborare est orare, to labour is to pray. Kids are like pissing cats or burrowing moles, marking off land within land, each section with its own rules, beliefs, laws of engagement. Despite every attempt to suppress it, the school contained and sustained patches, hangouts, disputed territories, satellite states, states of emergency, ghettos, enclaves, islands. There were no maps, but common sense told you, for example, not to fuck with the area between the refuse bins and the craft department. There had been casualties there, notably some poor sod called Keith who had his head placed in a vice, and the scrawny, sinewy kids who patrolled this area were not to be messed with. They were the thin sons of the fat men with vicious tabloids primed in their back pockets like handguns. The fat men who believe in rough justice, a life for a life, hangings too good for them. Across from there, the benches, three of them in a line. These were for the surreptitious dealing of tiny, tiny amounts of drugs. Things like £2.50 of marijuana resin, so small it was likely to be lost in your pencil case and confused with a shredded piece of eraser. Or a quarter of an E, the greatest use of which was soothing particularly persistent period pains. The gullible could also purchase of a variety of household goods, jasmine tea, garden grass, aspirin, licorice, flour, all masquerading as Class A intoxicants to be smoked or swallowed round the back in the hollow behind the drama department. This concave section of wall, depending where you stood, provided low teacher visibility for smokers too young to smoke in the smoker's garden, a concrete garden for those who had reached 16 and were allowed to smoke themselves silly. Are there any schools like this anymore? The drama hollow was to be avoided. These were hard little bastards, 12-13-year-old chain-smokers. They didn't give a shit. They really didn't give a shit. Your health, their health, teachers, parents, police, whatever. Smoking was their answer to the universe, their 42, their raison d'être. They were passionate about fags, not connoisseurs, not fussy about brand, just fags, any fags. They pulled at them like babies at teats, and when they were finally finished, they ground them into the mud with wet eyes. They fucking loved it. Fags, fags, fags. Their only interest outside fags was politics, or more precisely, this fucker, the Chancellor, who kept on putting up the price of fags. Because there was never enough money, and there were never enough fags. You had to become an expert in bumming, cadging, begging, stealing fags. A popular ploy was to blow a week's pocket money on 20, give them out to all and sundry, and spend the next month reminding those with fags about the time when you gave them a fag. But this was a high-risk policy. Better to have an utterly forgettable face, better to be able to cadge a fag and come back 5 minutes after for another without being remembered. Better to cultivate a cipher-like persona, be a little featureless squib called Mart, Jules, Ian. Otherwise, you had to rely on charity and fag sharing. One fag could be split in a myriad of ways. It worked like this. Someone, whoever had actually bought a pack of fags, lights up. Someone shouts, "Harbs." At the halfway point, the fag is passed over. As soon as it reaches the second person, we hear thirds, then saves, which is half a third, then But then, if the day is cold and the need for a fag overwhelming, last toke. But last toke is only for the desperate. It is beyond the perforation, beyond the brand name of the cigarette, beyond what could reasonably be described as the butt. Last toke is the yellowing fabric of the roach, containing the stuff that is less than tobacco, the stuff that collects in the lungs like a time bomb, destroys the immune system, and brings permanent sniffling nasal flu. The stuff that turns white teeth yellow. Everyone at Glenard Oak was at work. They were Babelians, of every conceivable class and colour, speaking in tongues, each in their own industrious corner, their busy censer mouths sending the votive offering of tobacco smoke to the many gods above them. Brent School's report, 1990, 67 different faiths, 123 different languages. Laborare est orare. Nerds by the pond, checking out frog sex. Posh girls in the music department singing French rounds, speaking pig Latin, going on grape diets, suppressing lesbian instincts. Fat boys in the PE corridor, wanking. High-strung girls outside the language block, reading murder casebooks. Indian kids playing cricket with tennis rackets on the football ground. Irie Jones looking for Milat Iqbal. Scott Breeze and Lisa Rainbow in the toilets, fucking. Joshua Chalfin, a goblin, an elder and a dwarf, behind the science block playing Goblins and Gorgons. And everybody, everybody smoking fags, 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 working hard at the begging of them, the lighting of them and the inhaling of them, the collecting of butts and the remaking of them, celebrating their power to bring people together across cultures and faiths, but mostly just smoking them. Giz a fag, spare us a fag. Chaffing on them like little chimneys till the smoke grows so thick that those who had stoked the chimneys here back in 1886, back in the days of the workhouse, would not have felt out of place. And through the fog, Irie was looking for Milat. She had tried the basketball court, the smoking garden, the music department, the cafeteria, the toilets of both sexes, and the graveyard that backed onto the school. She had to warn him. There was going to be a raid to catch all illicit smokers of weed or tobacco, a combined effort from the staff and the local constabulary. The seismic rumblings had come from Archie, angel of revelation. She had overheard his telephone conversation and the holy secrets of the parent-teacher association. Now Irie was landed with a burden far heavier than the seismologist, landed, rather, with the burden of the prophet, for she knew the day and time of the quake. Today, 2:30. She knew its power, possible expulsion, and she knew who was likely to fall victim to its fault line. She had to save him. Clutching her vibrating chub and sweating through 3 inches of afro hair, she dashed through the grounds, calling his name, inquiring of others, looking in all the usual places, but he was not with the Cockney Barry boys, the posh girls, the Indian posse, or the black kids. She trudged finally to the science block, part of the old workhouse and a much-loved blind spot of the school, its far wall and eastern corner affording 30 precious yards of grass, where a pupil indulging in illicit acts was entirely hidden from the common view. It was a fine, crisp autumn day. The place was full. Irie had to walk through the popular tonsil tennis, grouping championships, step over Joshua Chalfin's Goblins and Gorgons game. "Hey, watch your feet! Mind the cavern of the dead!" and furrow through a tight phalanx of fag smokers before she reached Milat at the epicentre of it all, pulling laconically on a cone-shaped joint, listening to a tall guy with a mighty beard. "Mill! Not right now, Jones. But Mill, please, Jones. This is Hiffan, old friend. I'm trying to listen to him." The tall guy, Hiffan, had not paused in his speech. He had a deep, soft voice like running water, inevitable and constant, requiring a force stronger than the sudden appearance of Irie, stronger, maybe, than gravity, to stop it. He was dressed in a sharp black suit, a white shirt and a green bow tie. His breast pocket was embroidered with a small emblem, 2 hands cupping a flame and something underneath it too small to see. Though no older than Milat, his hair-growing capacity was striking, and his beard aged him considerably.
"And so, marijuana weakens one's abilities, one's power, and takes our best men away from us in this country, Men like you, Milad, who have natural leadership skills, who possess within them the ability to take a people by the hand and lift them up. There is an hadith from the Bukhari, part 5, page 2. The best people of my community are my contemporaries and supporters. You are my contemporary, Milad. I pray you will also become my supporter. There's a war going on, Milad. A war.
He continued like this, one word flowing from another, with no punctuation or breath, and with the same chocolatey delivery. One could almost climb into his sentences. One could almost fall asleep in them. Mil, Mil, it's important.
Milad looked drowsy, whether from the hash or Hifan wasn't clear. Shaking Irie off his sleeve, he attempted an introduction.
Irie, Hifan. Him and me used to go about together. Hifan?
Hifan stepped forward, looming over Irie like a bell tower.
Good to meet you, sister. I am Hifan.
Great. Milad, Irie, man, shit! Could you just chill for 1 minute?
He passed her the smoke.
I'm trying to listen to the guy, yeah? Hifan is the don. Look at the suit. Gangster styley.
Milad ran a finger down Hifan's lapel, and Hifan, against his better instinct, beamed with pleasure.
Seriously, Hifan, man, you look wicked. Crisp.
Yeah?
Better than that stuff you used to go around in back when we used to hang, eh? Back in them Kilburn days? Remember when we went to Bradford and...
Hifan remembered himself, resumed his previous face of pious determination.
I'm afraid I don't remember the Kilburn days, brother. I did things in ignorance then. That was a different person.
Yeah,
said Milad sheepishly.
Course.
Milad gave Hifan a joshing punch on the shoulder, in response to which Hifan stood still as a gatepost.
So, there's a fucking spiritual war going on. That's fucking crazy. About time. We need to make our mark in this bloody country. What was the name again of your lot?
I am from the Kilburn branch of the Keepers of the Eternal and Victorious Islamic Nation, said Hifan proudly.
Irie inhaled.
Keepers of the Eternal and Victorious Islamic Nation, repeated Milad, impressed. That's a wicked name. It's got a wicked kung fu kick-ass sound to it.
Irie frowned. Kevin?
We are aware, said Hifan solemnly, pointing to the spot underneath the cupped flame where the initials were minutely embroidered, that we have an acronym problem.
Just a bit.
But the name is Allah's and it cannot be changed. But to continue with what I was saying, Milad, my friend, you could be the head of the Cricklewood branch.
Mil,
you could have what I have, instead of this terrible confusion you are in, instead of this reliance on a drug specifically imported by governments to subdue the black and Asian community to lessen our powers.
Yeah,
said Milad sadly, in mid-roll of a new spliff.
I don't really look at it like that. I guess I should look at it like that. Mil, Jones, give it a rest. I'm having a fucking debate. Hifan, what school are you at now, mate?
Hifan shook his head with a smile.
I left the English education system some time ago, but my education is far from over. If I can quote to you from the Tabrizi, hadith number 220, the person who goes in search of knowledge is on active service for God until he returns and the...
Mil,
whispered Irie, beneath Hifan's flow of mellifluous sound.
Mil, for fuck's sake, what? Sorry, Hifan, mate, 1 minute.
Irie pulled deeply on her joint and relayed her news. Milad sighed.
Irie, they come in one side and we go out the other. No biggie, it's a regular deal, all right? Now why don't you go and play with the kiddies? Serious business here.
It was good to meet you, Irie, said Hifan, reaching out his hand and looking her up and down. If I might say so, it is refreshing to see a woman who dresses demurely, wearing her hair short. Kevin believes a woman should not feel the need to pander to the erotic fantasies of Western sexuality.
Yeah, thanks.
Feeling sorry for herself and more than a bit stoned, Irie made her way back through the wall of smoke and stepped through Joshua Chalfin's Goblins and Gorgons game once more.
Hey, we're trying to play here.
Irie whipped round, full of swallowed fury.
And?
Joshua's friends, a fat kid, a spotty kid, and a kid with an abnormally large head, shrank back in fear. But Joshua stood his ground. He played oboe behind Irie's second viola in the excuse for a school orchestra, and he had often observed her strange hair and broad shoulders and thought he might have half a chance there. She was clever and not entirely unpretty, and there was something in her that had a strong, nerdy flavour about it, despite that boy she spent her time with, the Indian one. She hung around him, but she wasn't like him. Joshua Chalfin strongly suspected her of being one of his own. There was something innate in her that he felt he could bring out. She was a nerd immigrant who had fled the land of the fat, facially challenged and disarmingly clever. She had scaled the mountains of Kaldor, swum the river Leviathrax, and braved the chasm Duluin in the mad dash away from her true countrymen to another land. "I'm just saying, you seem pretty keen to step into the land of Golthon. Do you want to play with us?" "No, I don't want to play with you, you fucking prick. I don't even know you. Joshua Chalfin, I was in Manor Primary, we were in English together, and we're in orchestra together." "No, we're not. I'm in orchestra, you're in orchestra, in no sense are we there together." The goblin, the elder, and the dwarf, who appreciated a good play on words, had a snivelly giggle at that one. But insults meant nothing to Joshua. Joshua was the Cyrano de Bergerac of taking insults. He'd taken insults from the affectionate end, Chalfin the chubster, posh Josh, Josh with the Jufro, from the other, that hippie fuck, curly-haired cocksucker, shit-eater. He'd taken never-ending insults all his damn life and survived, coming out the other side to smug. An insult was but a pebble in his path, only proving the intellectual inferiority of she who threw it. He continued regardless. "I like what you've done with your hair." "Are you taking the piss?" "No. I like short hair on girls. I like that androgyny thing. Seriously. What is your fucking problem?" Joshua shrugged. "Nothing. The vaguest acquaintance with basic Freudian theory would suggest you are the one with the problem. Where does all that aggression come from? I thought smoking was meant to chill you out. Can I have some?" Irie had forgotten the burning joint in her hand. "Oh, yeah, right. Regular puffhead, are we?" "I dabble." The dwarf, elder and goblin emitted some snorts and liquid noises. "Oh, sure," sighed Irie, reaching down to pass it to him. "Whatever." "Irie!" It was Millat. He had forgotten to take his joint off Irie and was now running over to retrieve it. Irie, about to hand it over to Joshua, turning around in mid-action, at one and the same time, spotted Millat coming towards her and felt a rumble in the ground, a tremor that shook Joshua's tiny cast-iron goblin army to their knees and then swept them off the board.
"What the?"
said Millat. It was the raid committee, taking the suggestion of parent Governor Archibald Jones, an ex-army man who claimed expertise in the field of ambush. They had resolved to come from both sides, never before tested. Their hundred-strong party utilising the element of surprise, giving no pre-warning bar the sound of their approaching feet, simply boxing the little bastards in, thus cutting off any escape route for the enemy and catching the likes of Millat Iqbal, Irie Jones, and Joshua Chalfin in the very act of marijuana consumption. The headmaster of Glenard Oak was in a continual state of implosion. His hairline had gone out and stayed out like a determined tide. His eye sockets were deep, his lips had been sucked backwards into his mouth. He had no body to speak of, or rather he folded what he had into a small, twisted package, sealing it with a pair of crossed arms and crossed legs. As if to counter this personal, internal collapse, the headmaster had the seating arranged in a large circle, an expansive gesture he hoped would help everybody speak to and see each other, allowing everybody to express their point and make themselves heard, so together they could work towards problem-solving rather than behaviour chastisement. Some parents worried the headmaster was a bleeding-heart liberal. If you asked Tina, his secretary, not that no one ever did ask Tina a bloody thing,
Oh, no, no fear. Only questions like, so what are these three scallywags up for, then?
It was more like a hemorrhage.
So, said the headmaster to Tina with a doleful smile, what are these three scallywags up for, then?
Wearily, Tina read out the three counts of marijuana, possession. Irie put her hand up to object, but the headmaster silenced her with a gentle smile.
I see. That'll be all, Tina. If you could just leave the door ajar on your way out, yes, that's it, bit more fine. Don't want anyone to feel boxed in, as it were. Okay, now, I think the most civilised way to do this, said the headmaster, laying his hands palm up and flat on his knees, to demonstrate he was packing no weapons, so we don't have everybody talking over each other, is if I say my bit, you each then say your bit, starting with you, Milat, and ending with Joshua. And then once we've taken on board all that's been said, I get to say my final bit, and that's it. Relatively painless. All right? All right.
I need a fag, said Milat. The headmaster rearranged himself. He uncrossed his right leg and slung his skinny left leg over instead. He brought his two forefingers up to his lips in the shape of a church spire. He retracted his head like a turtle.
Milat, please. Have you got a fag tray?
No.
Now, Milat, come on.
I'll just go and have one at the gates, then.
In this manner, the whole school held the headmaster to ransom. He couldn't have 1,000 kids lining the Cricklewood streets, smoking fags, bringing down the tone of the school. This was the age of the league table, of picky parents nosing their way through the Times educational supplement, summing up schools in letters and numbers and inspectors' reports. The headmaster was forced to switch off the fire alarms for terms at a time, hiding his 1,000 smokers within the school's confines.
Oh, look, just move your chair closer to the window. Come on, come on, don't make a song and dance about it. That's it. All right?
A Lambert and Butler hung from Millat's lips.
Light?
The headmaster rifled about in his own shirt pocket, where a packet of German rolling tobacco and a lighter were buried amidst a lot of tissue paper and biros.
There you go.
Milat lit up, blowing smoke in the headmaster's direction. The headmaster coughed like an old woman.
Okay, Milat, you first, because I expect this of you, at least. Spill the legumes.
Milat said,
I was round there, back of the science block, on a matter of spiritual growth.
The headmaster leant forward and tapped the church spire against his lips a few times.
You're going to have to give me a little more to work on, Milat. Now, there's some religious connection here. It can only work in your favour, but I need to know about it.
Milat elaborated.
I was talking to my mate Hifan.
The headmaster shook his head.
I'm not following you, Milat.
He's a spiritual leader.
I was getting some advice. Spiritual leader? Hifan? Is he in the school? Are we talking cult here, Milat? I need to know if we're talking cult.
No, it's not a bloody cult, barked Irie, exasperated.
Can we get on with it? I've got Viola in 10 minutes.
Milat speaking, Irie. We're listening to Milat, and hopefully when we get to you, Milat will give you a bit more respect than you've just showed him.
Okay? We've got to have communication.
Okay, Milat, go on. What kind of spiritual leader?
Muslim. He was helping me with my faith, yeah? He's the head of the Cricklewood branch of the Keepers of the Eternal and Victorious Islamic Nation.
The headmaster frowned.
Kevin?
They are aware they have an acronym problem, explained Irie.
So, continued the headmaster eagerly, this guy from Kevin, was he the one who was supplying the gear?
No, said Milat, stubbing his fag out on the windowsill.
It was my gear. He was talking to me and I was smoking it.
Look, said Irie, after a few more minutes of circular conversation. It's very simple. It was Milat's gear. I smoked it without really thinking. Then I gave it to Joshua to hold for a second while I tied my shoelace, but he really had nothing to do with it, okay?
Can we go now?
Yes, I did.
Irie turned to Joshua.
What? She's trying to cover for me. Some of it was my marijuana. I was dealing marijuana, then the pigs jumped me.
Jesus Christ, Chalfin, you're nuts. Maybe. But in the past 2 days, Joshua had gained more respect, been patted on the back by more people, and generally lauded it around more than he ever had in his life. Some of the glamour of Millat seemed to have rubbed off on him by association, and as for Irie, well, he'd allowed a vague interest to develop in the past 2 days into a full-blown crush. Wipe that. He had a full-blown crush on both of them. There was something compelling about them, more so than Elgin the dwarf or Moloch the sorcerer. He liked being connected with them, however tenuously. He had been plucked by the two of them out of nerddom, accidentally whisked from obscurity into the school spotlight. He wasn't going back without a struggle. Is this true, Joshua?
Yes. It started small, but now I believe I have a real problem. I don't want to deal drugs. Obviously I don't. But it's like a compulsion.
Oh, for God's sake.
Now, Irie, you have to let Joshua have his say. His say is as valid as your say.
Millat reached over to the headmaster's pocket and pulled out his heavy packet of tobacco. He poured the contents out onto the small coffee table.
Oi, Chalfin, get a boy. Measure out an eighth.
Joshua looked at the stinking mountain of brown.
A European eighth or an English eighth? Could you just do as Millat suggests?
Said the headmaster irritably, leaning forward in his chair to inspect the tobacco.
So we can settle this.
Fingers shaking, Joshua drew a section of tobacco onto his palm and held it up. The headmaster brought Joshua's hand up under Millat's nose for inspection.
Barely a 5-pound draw, said Millat scornfully. I wouldn't buy shit from you. Okay, Joshua, said the headmaster, putting the tobacco back in its pouch. I think we can safely say the game's up. Even I knew that wasn't anywhere near an eighth. But it does concern me that you felt the need to lie, and we're going to have to schedule a time to talk about that.
Yes, sir.
In the meantime, I've talked to your parents, and in line with the school policy, move away from behaviour chastisement and towards constructive conduct management. They very generously suggested a 2-month programme.
Programme?
Every Tuesday and Thursday, you, Millat, and you, Irie, will go to Joshua's house and join him in a 2-hour after-school study group split between maths and biology, your weaker subjects and his stronger.
Irie snorted.
You're not serious.
You know I am serious. I think it's a really interesting idea. This way, Joshua's strengths can be shared equally amongst you, and the two of you can go to a stable environment, and one with the added advantage of keeping you both off the streets. I've talked to your parents, and they are happy with the, you know, arrangement. And what's really exciting is that Joshua's father is something of an eminent scientist, and his mother is a horticulturist, I believe. So, you know, you'll really get a lot out of it. You two have a lot of potential. But I feel you're getting caught up with things that really are damaging to that potential. Whether that's family, environment, or personal hassles, I don't know. But this is a really good opportunity to escape those. I hope you'll see that it's more than punishment. It's constructive. It's people helping people. And I really hope you'll do this wholeheartedly. You know? This kind of thing is very much in the history, the spirit, the whole ethos of Glenard Oak, ever since Sir Glenard himself.
The history, spirit and ethos of Glenard Oak, as any Glenardian worth their salt knew, could be traced back to Sir Edmund Flecker Glenard, 1842 to 1907, whom the school had decided to remember as their kindly Victorian benefactor. The official party line stated that Glenard had donated the money for the original building out of a devoted interest in the social improvement of the disadvantaged. Rather than workhouse, the official PTA booklet described it as a shelter, workplace and educational institute, used in its time by a mixture of English and Caribbean people. According to the PTA booklet, the founder of Glenard Oak was an educational philanthropist. But then, according to the PTA booklet, post-class aberration consideration period was a suitable replacement for the word detention. A more thorough investigation in the archives of the local Grange Library would reveal Sir Edmund Flecker Glenard as a successful colonial who had made a pretty sum in Jamaica farming tobacco, or rather overseeing great tracts of land where tobacco was being farmed. At the end of 20 years of this, having acquired far more money than was necessary, Sir Edmund sat back in his impressive leather armchair and asked himself if there was not something he could do, something to send him into his dotage, cushioned by a feeling of goodwill and worthiness. Something for the people, the ones he could see from his window out there in the field. For a few months, Sir Edmund was stumped. Then, one Sunday, while taking a leisurely late afternoon stroll through Kingston, he heard a familiar sound that struck him differently. Godly singing, hand-clapping, weeping and wailing, noise and heat and ecstatic movement coming from church after church and moving through the thick air of Jamaica like a choir invisible. Now, there was something, thought Sir Edmund. For, unlike many of his expatriate peers who branded the singing caterwauling and accused it of being heathen, Sir Edmund had always been touched by the devotion of Jamaican Christians. He liked the idea of a jolly church, where one could sniff or cough or make a sudden movement without the vicar looking at one queerly. Sir Edmund felt certain that God, in all his wisdom, had never meant church to be a stiff-collared, miserable affair, as it was in Tunbridge Wells, but rather a joyous thing, a singing and dancing thing, a foot-stamping, hand-clapping thing. The Jamaicans understood this. Sometimes it seemed to be the only thing they did understand. Stopping for a moment outside one particularly vibrant church, Sir Edmund took the opportunity to muse upon this conundrum. The remarkable difference between a Jamaican's devotion to his God in comparison to his devotion towards his employer. It was a subject he'd had cause to consider many times in the past. Only this month, as he sat in his study, trying to concentrate on the problem he had set himself, his wardens came to him with news of 3 strikes, various men found asleep or drugged while at work, and a whole collective of mothers, Bowden women amongst them, complaining about low pay, refusing to work. Now you see, that was the rub of it, right there. You could get a Jamaican to pray any hour of the day or night. They would roll into church for any date of religious note, even the most obscure. But if you took your eye off them for 1 minute in the tobacco fields, then work ground to a halt. When they worshipped, they were full of energy, moving like jumping beans, bawling in the aisles. Yet when they worked, they were sullen and uncooperative. The question so puzzled him, he had written a letter on the subject to the Gleaner earlier in the year, inviting correspondence, but received no satisfactory replies. The more Edmund thought about it, the more it became clear to him that the situation was quite the opposite in England. One was impressed by the Jamaican's faith, but despairing of his work ethic and education. Vice versa, one admired the Englishman's work ethic and education, but despaired of his poorly kept faith. And now, as Sir Edmund turned to go back to his estate, he realized that he was in a position to influence the situation. Nay, more than that, transform it. Sir Edmund, who was a fairly corpulent man, a man who looked as if he might be hiding another man within him, practically skipped all the way home. The very next day, he wrote an electrifying letter to the Times and donated £40,000 to a missionary group on the condition that it went towards a large property in London. Here, Jamaicans could work side by side with Englishmen packaging Sir Edmund's cigarettes and taking general instruction from the Englishman in the evening. A small chapel was to be built as an annex to the main factory. And on Sundays, continued Sir Edmund, the Jamaicans were to take the Englishmen to church and show them what worship should look like. The thing was built, and after hastily promising them streets of gold, Sir Edmund shipped 300 Jamaicans to North London. 2 weeks later, from the other side of the world, the Jamaican sent Glenard a telegraph confirming their safe arrival, and Glenard sent one back suggesting a Latin motto be put underneath the plaque already bearing his name. Laborare est orare. For a while, things went reasonably well. The Jamaicans were optimistic about England. They put the freezing climate to the back of their minds and were inwardly warmed by Sir Edmund's sudden enthusiasm and interest in their welfare. But Sir Edmund had always had difficulties retaining enthusiasm and interest. His mind was a small thing with big holes, through which passions regularly seeped out, and the faith of Jamaicans was soon replaced in the inverse sieve of his consciousness by other interests, the excitability of the military Hindu, the impracticalities of the English virgin, the effect of extreme heat on the sexual proclivities of the Trinidadian. For the next 15 years, apart from fairly regular checks sent by Sir Edmund's clerk, the Glenard Oak factory heard nothing from him. Then, in the 1907 Kingston earthquake, Glenard was crushed to death by a toppled marble Madonna while Iris' grandmother looked on. These are old secrets. They will come out like wisdom teeth when the time is right. The date was unfortunate. That very month, he had planned to return to British shores to see how his long-neglected experiment was doing. A letter he had written, giving the details of his travelling plans, arrived at Glenard Oak around the same time a worm, having made the 2-day passage through his brain, emerged from the poor man's left ear. But though a vermiculous meal was made of him, Glenard was saved a nasty ordeal, for his experiment was doing badly. The overheads involved in shipping damp, heavy tobacco to England were impractical from the start. When Sir Edmund's subsidies dried up 6 months previous, the business went under, the missionary group discreetly disappeared, and the Englishmen left to go to jobs elsewhere. The Jamaicans, unable to get work elsewhere, stayed, counting down the days until the food supplies ran out. They were, by now, entirely sensible of the subjunctive mood. The nine times table, the life and times of William the Conqueror, and the nature of an equilateral triangle. But they were hungry. Some died of that hunger. Some were jailed for the petty crimes hunger prompts. Many crept awkwardly into the East End and the English working class. A few found themselves 17 years later at the British Empire Exhibition of 1924, dressed up as Jamaicans in the Jamaican exhibit, acting out a horrible simulacrum of their previous existence, tin drums, coral necklaces, for they were English now, more English than the English by virtue of their disappointments. All in all, then, the headmaster was wrong. Glenard could not be said to have passed on any great edifying beacon to future generations. A legacy is not something you can give or take by choice, and there are no certainties in the sticky business of inheritance. Much though it may have dismayed him, Glenard's influence turned out to be personal, not professional or educational. It ran through people's blood and the blood of their families. It ran through 3 generations of immigrants who could feel both abandoned and hungry even when in the bosom of their families in front of a mighty feast. And it even ran through Irie Jones of Jamaica's Bowden clan, though she didn't know it. But then somebody should have told her to keep a backward eye on Glenard. Jamaica is a small place. You can walk around it in a day. And everybody who lived there rubbed up against everybody else at one time or another.
"Do we really have a choice?" asked Irie.
"You've been honest with me," said the headmaster, biting his colourless lip. "And I want to be honest with you."
"We don't have a choice."
"Honestly, no. It's really that, or 2 months of post-class aberration consideration periods. I'm afraid we have to please the people, Irie. And if we can't please all of the people all of the time, we can at least please some of..."
"Yeah, great."
"Joshua's parents are really fascinating people, Irie. I think this whole experience is going to be really educational for you. Don't you think so, Joshua?"
Joshua beamed.
"Oh, yes, sir. I really think so. And, you know, the exciting thing is, this could be a kind of guinea pig project for a whole range of programs," said the headmaster, thinking aloud. "Bringing children of disadvantaged or minority backgrounds into contact with kids who might have something to offer them. And there could be an exchange, vice versa. Kids teaching kids basketball, football, etc. We could get funding."
At the magic word, funding, the headmaster's sunken eyes began to disappear beneath agitated lids.
"Shit, man," said Millat, shaking his head in disbelief. "I need a fag."
"Halves," said Irie, following him out.
"See you guys on Tuesday," said Joshua.
12. Canines. The ripping teeth. If it is not too far-fetched a comparison, the sexual and cultural revolution